I had to come up with something else, and fast. I had the horrid sense that the tunnel was tightening around me. It seemed alive. "There's not much time," Dona Ana had said. Cold sweat trickled from my armpits. "Come on now, remember something," Komi's voice said behind me. "Something you can physically touch, something you can draw." Like a drowning man clutching a buoy, I latched on to my old Peugeot 205, my little French car. I remembered the feeling of the steering wheel as I toured northeastern Japan and Hokkaido. It felt like ages ago, yet I could still hear the rattle of that primitive four-cylinder engine and the way the clutch growled when I shifted from second into third. For a month and a half, the car had been my constant comrade, my only friend. Now it was probably sitting in a scrapyard somewhere. The tunnel was definitely narrowing. My head kept banging against the roof. I reached for the flashlight. "Do not turn on the light," Dona Ana commanded. "But I can't see where I'm going." "You must not see," she said. "Not with your eyes." "The hole is closing in. If I go on, I won't be able to move." There was no answer. "I can't go any farther," I said. "What should I do?" Again, no answer. I could no longer hear Dona Ana and Komi. I sensed they were gone. All that remained was a deep silence. The tunnel continued to shrink, making it even harder for me to advance. Panic was setting in. My limbs felt paralyzed. Just drawing a breath was growing difficult. A voice whispered in my ear. "You are trapped," it said. "This is your coffin. You cannot move forward. You cannot move backward. You will lie buried here forever, forsaken by humanity in this dark and narrow tomb." I sensed something approaching from behind, a flattish thing crawling toward me through the dark. It wasn't Dona Ana, nor was it Komi. In fact, it wasn't human. I could hear the scraping of its many feet and its ragged breathing. It stopped when it reached me. There followed a few moments of silence. It seemed to be holding its breath, planning its next move. Then something cold and slimy touched my bare ankle. The end of a long tentacle, it seemed. Sheer terror coursed up my back. Could this be a double metaphor? That which stemmed from the darkness within me? "I know where you were and what you were doing." I couldn't recall a thing. Not the black cat, not the Peugeot 205, not the Commendatore. Everything was gone. My memory had been wiped clean a second time. I squirmed and twisted, frantically trying to escape the tentacle. The tunnel had contracted even farther. I could barely move. I was trying to force myself into a space smaller than my body. That was a clear contravention of basic principles. It didn't take a genius to figure out it was physically impossible. Nevertheless, I kept on thrusting, pushing myself forward. As Dona Ana had said, this was the path I had chosen, and it was too late to choose another. The Commendatore had died to make my quest possible. I had stabbed him with my own hands. His body had sunk in a pool of blood. I couldn't allow him to die for nothing. And the owner of that clammy tentacle was trying to get me in its grips. Rallying my spirits, I pressed on. I could feel my sweater unravel as it caught and tore on the rock. I awkwardly squirmed ahead, loosening my joints like an escape artist slipping his bonds. My pace was no faster than that of a caterpillar. The narrow tunnel was squeezing me like a giant vise. My bones and muscles screamed. The slimy tentacle slithered farther up my ankle. Soon it would cover me as I lay there in the impenetrable dark, unable to move. I would no longer be the person I was. Jettisoning all reason, I mustered what strength I had left and forced myself into the ever-narrowing space. Every part of my body shrieked in pain, yet I had to push forward, whatever the consequences, even if I had to dislocate every joint, however agonizing that would be. For everything around me was the product of connectivity. Nothing was absolute. Pain was a metaphor. The tentacle clutching my leg was a metaphor. All was relative. Light was shadow. Shadow was light. I had no choice but to believe. What else could I do? The tunnel ended without warning, spitting me out like a clump of grass from a clogged drainpipe. I flew through the air, utterly defenseless. There was no time to think. I must have fallen at least 6 feet before I hit the ground. Luckily, it wasn't solid rock, but relatively soft earth. I curled and rolled as I fell, tucking in my head to protect it from the impact. A judo move, done without thinking. I whacked my shoulder and hip on landing, but I barely felt it. Darkness surrounded me, and my flashlight was gone. I seemed to have dropped it when I tumbled out. I remained on all fours, not moving. I couldn't see anything. I couldn't think anything. I was only aware, and barely at that, of a growing pain in my joints. Every tendon, every bone wailed in protest at what it had been put through during my escape. Yes, I had escaped that dreadful tunnel. The realization hit me at last. I could still feel the eerie tentacle sliding over my ankle. I was grateful to have eluded that thing, whatever it was. But then, where was I now? There was no breeze, but there was smell. The odor I had caught a whiff of in the tunnel was everywhere. I couldn't recall where I had encountered it before. Nevertheless, this place was dead quiet. Not a sound anywhere. I needed to find my flashlight. I carefully searched the ground where I had fallen, on all fours in a widening circle. The earth was moist. I was scared that I might touch something creepy in the dark, but there was nothing, not even a pebble. Just ground so perfectly flat, it must have been leveled by human hands. After a long search, I finally found the flashlight lying about 3 feet from where I had landed. The moment my hand touched its plastic casing was one of the happiest of my life. But I didn't switch it on right away. Instead, I closed my eyes and took a number of deep breaths, as if I were patiently unraveling a stubborn knot. My breathing slowed. My heartbeat did too, and my muscles began to return to normal. I slowly exhaled the last deep breath and switched on the flashlight. Its yellow light raced through the darkness, but I couldn't look yet. My eyes had grown too used to the dark. The tiniest light made my head split with pain. I shielded my eyes with one hand until I could open my fingers enough to peer through the cracks. From what I could see, I had landed on the floor of a circular-shaped room, a room of modest size with walls of stone. I shone the flashlight above my head. The room had a ceiling. No, not exactly that. Something more like a lid. No light seeped through. I realized where I was. In the pit in the woods, behind the little shrine. I had crawled into the tunnel in Dona Ana's cave and tumbled out onto the floor of this stone chamber. I was in a real pit in the real world, I had no idea how that could have happened, but it had. I was back at the beginning, so to speak. But why was there no light? The lid was made of wooden boards. There were cracks between those boards, through which some light should enter. Yet none did. I was stumped. At least I knew where I was. The smell was a dead giveaway. Why had it taken me so long to figure out? I carefully examined my surroundings with my flashlight. The metal ladder that should have been standing there was gone. Someone must have pulled it out and carted it off, which meant there was no means of escape. What I found strange, it should have been strange, I guess, was that I could find no trace of the opening, no matter how hard I looked. I had exited the narrow tunnel and fallen onto the floor of this pit, like a newborn baby pushed out in midair, yet I couldn't find the aperture. It was as if it had closed after it spit me out. Eventually, the flashlight's beam illuminated an object on the ground, something I recognized. It was the old bell the Commendatore had rung. Hearing it had led me to discover the pit. Everything had begun with this bell. I had left it on the shelf in the studio. Then at some point it had vanished. I picked it up and examined it under the flashlight. It had an old wooden handle. There could be no doubt. It was that bell. I stared at it for some time, trying to understand. Had someone brought it back? Had it returned under its own power? The Commendatore had told me the bell belonged to the pit. What did that mean, belonged to the pit? But I was too tired to figure out the principles that might explain what was taking place, and there was no pillar of logic I could lean on. I sat down, back against the stone wall, and switched off the flashlight. I had to figure out how to escape from this pit. I didn't need light for that, and it was important to conserve the batteries. So what should I do now?
Chapter 56. It appears that several blanks need filling in. A number of things made no sense. Most troubling of all was the total absence of light. Someone had sealed the pit's opening, but who would do such a thing, and why? I prayed that someone, whoever it was, hadn't piled boulders on top of the lid, returning it to how it had been in the beginning. That would mean my chances of getting out were practically zero. A thought struck me. I clicked on the flashlight and checked my watch. It read 4:32. The second hand was circling the face, doing its job. Time was passing, no doubt about it. At least I was back where time flowed at a set pace and in a single direction. Yet what was time, when you got right down to it? We measured its passage with the hands of a clock for convenience's sake. But was that appropriate? Did time really flow in such a steady and linear way? Couldn't this be a mistaken way of thinking? An error of major proportions? I clicked off the flashlight and, with a long sigh, returned to absolute darkness. Enough pondering time, enough pondering space. Thinking about stuff like that led nowhere. It only added to my stress. I had to think about things that were concrete, things I could see and touch. So I thought about Yuzu. She was certainly something I could see with my eyes and touch with my hands, if I was ever given that opportunity again. Now she was pregnant. This coming January, the child, not my child, but that of some other man, would be born. That situation continued without my involvement, in a place far removed from me. A new life with which I had no connection would enter this world, Yuzu had asked nothing of me. So why was she refusing to marry the father? I couldn't figure it out. If she planned to be a single mother, odds were she'd have to quit her job at the architectural firm. I doubted that a small business like that could extend a lengthy maternity leave to a new mother. I could find no convincing answers to these questions, though I tried. I was stumped, and the darkness made me feel even more powerless. If I ever got out of this pit, I would put aside my hesitations and go see Yuzu. No question about it, I was hurt when she left me for someone else. It angered me, too, although it took me a very long time to realize that. But why carry around my resentments for the rest of my life? I would go meet her, and we could talk things out. I needed to know from Yuzu herself what she was thinking and what she wanted, before it was too late. Once I made that decision, I felt a little easier. If she wanted to be friends, well, maybe I could give it a shot. It wasn't beyond the realm of possibility, at least. Perhaps we could resolve things that way. If I managed to get out of the pit, that is. After this, I fell asleep. I had shed my leather jacket before entering the tunnel. What fate lay in store for that jacket of mine? And the cold was starting to get to me. The thin sweater I had on over my t-shirt had been so shredded by the walls of the tunnel that it was a sweater in name only. Moreover, I had returned to the real world from the land of metaphor. In other words, I was back where time and temperature played their proper roles. Yet my need for sleep won out. I drifted off, sitting there on the ground, leaning against the hard stone wall. It was a pure sleep, free of dream or deception, a solitary sleep beyond anyone's reach, like the Spanish gold resting on the floor of the Irish Sea. It was still pitch black when I woke up. I couldn't see my finger when I waved it in front of my face. The darkness blotted out the line between sleep and wakefulness as well. Where did one end and the other begin, and which side was I on? I dragged out my bag of memories and began flipping through them, as if counting a stack of gold coins. The black cat that had been our pet, my old Peugeot 205, Manshiki's white mansion, the record Der Rosenkavalier, the plastic penguin. I was able to call up memories of each in great detail. My mind was working okay. The double metaphor hadn't devoured it. It's just that I had been in total darkness for so long that I was having trouble drawing a line between the world of sleep and the waking world. I switched on the flashlight, covered it with my hand, and read my watch in the light leaking between my fingers. 1:18. Last time I looked, it was 4:32. Could I have been sleeping in such an uncomfortable position for 9 hours? That was hard to believe. If that were true, I should be a lot stiffer. It seemed more reasonable to assume that, unbeknownst to me, time had traveled backward 3 hours. But I couldn't be certain either way. Being immersed in the dark for so long had obliterated my sense of time. In any case, the cold had grown more penetrating, and I had to pee, badly. Resigning myself, I shuffled to the other side of the pit and let it all out. It was a long pee that the ground quickly absorbed. A faint smell of ammonia lingered, but only for a moment. Once the need to pee had been taken care of, hunger stepped in to take its place. By slow and steady degrees, it seemed, my body was readapting to the real world. Perhaps the effects of the water I had drunk from the river of metaphor were wearing off. I had to get out of the pit as soon as possible. I felt that more urgently now. If I didn't, it wouldn't take long to starve to death. Human beings can only sustain life if provided with food and water. That was a basic rule of the real world, and my present location had neither. All I had was air, though the lid was closed. Air seemed to be leaking in from somewhere. Air, love, and ideals were important, no argument there, but you couldn't survive on them alone. I pulled myself off the ground and attempted to scale the pit's smooth stone wall. I tried from a number of spots, but as I expected, it was a waste of energy. The wall was less than 9 feet high, but it was straight up and down, with nothing at all to grab onto. It would take superhuman ability to climb, and even if I reached the top, there was still that heavy lid to deal with. I would need a solid foothold to push that aside. I sat back down, resigned. Only one option presented itself. I could ring the bell, as the Commendatore had done. But there was one big difference between the Commendatore and me. He was an idea, while I was a flesh-and-blood human being. An idea never felt hunger, while I did. An idea wouldn't starve to death, whereas I would, relatively quickly. The Commendatore could ring the bell for 100 years, though the concept of time was foreign to him, and not get tired, while my limit without food and water was probably 3 or 4 days. After that, I wouldn't have the strength, though the bell was light. So I began ringing the bell there in the dark. There was nothing else to do. Of course, I could call out for help, but the pit was in the middle of a deserted woods. Since the woods was the private property of the Amada family, under normal circumstances there would be no one around. To make matters worse, the cover of the pit had been sealed tight. I could shout at the top of my lungs and no one would hear. My voice would just grow hoarse, and I would become even thirstier. At least shaking the bell was better than nothing. Moreover, there was something out of the ordinary about the bell's ring. It seemed to have some special power. In physical terms, it wasn't very loud, yet I had heard it from my distant bed in the middle of the night. The autumn insects had fallen silent the moment they heard that ringing, as if commanded to stop their racket. So I sat there at the bottom of the pit, my back against the stone wall, and rang the bell. I shook my wrist from side to side and emptied my mind as best I could. When I got tired, I took a break and then started again, as the Commendatore had done before me. It wasn't hard to clear my mind. When I listened to the bell, I felt quite naturally that I didn't have to think about anything else. The ringing sounded different in the dark than in the light. I'm pretty sure that difference was real. I was stuck in a black hole with no way out, but as long as I was shaking the bell, I felt neither fear nor anxiety. I could forget cold and hunger as well. For the most part, I could even set aside my need to analyze what was taking place. This was a welcome change, as you can imagine. When I tired of ringing the bell, I dozed off, leaning against the stone wall. When I awoke, I switched on the flashlight and checked my watch. Time, I discovered, was behaving in a very haphazard manner. Of course, this may have had more to do with me than the watch, no question there. But that haphazardness was fine with me. I just went on mindlessly ringing the bell, then falling asleep, then waking up to ring the bell again. An endless repetition. With the repetition, my consciousness grew ever more thin and rarefied. Not a single sound made its way into the pit. I couldn't hear the birds or the wind. What could explain that? This was supposed to be the real world. I was back in a place where people felt hunger and the need to pee. The real world ought to be filled with all kinds of noises. I had no idea how much time had passed. I had given up checking my watch. The passing of days made even less sense than the passage of minutes and hours. How could it be otherwise in a place that lacked day and night?
Not just time, either. I was losing contact with my own self. My body had become a stranger to me. I was finding it harder and harder to understand what my physical existence meant, or perhaps I didn't care to understand. All I could do was keep ringing that bell until my wrist was almost numb. After what felt like an eternity, or after time had surged and ebbed like waves pounding the shore, and my hunger became unbearable, finally I heard something above my head. It sounded as if someone had grabbed hold of a corner of the world and was trying to peel back its skin. But the sound didn't strike my ear as real. I mean, how could anyone do that? And if they succeeded, what would follow? A fresh new world, or an endless nothing? In truth, though, I didn't care one way or the other. The final result would probably be more or less the same. There in the dark, I closed my eyes and waited for the peeling of the world to conclude. But the world wasn't to be peeled so easily, it seemed, and the din only mounted. Maybe it was real after all. An actual object undergoing a process that produced an actual physical sound. Steeling myself, I opened my eyes and looked up. I trained the beam of my flashlight on the ceiling. Someone was up there making an awful racket. I didn't know why, but it was an ear-splitting, grinding noise. I couldn't tell if the sound threatened me or was being made on my behalf. Whichever the case, I just sat there at the bottom of the pit, shaking my bell, waiting to see how things would turn out. At last, a thin sheet of light shot through a crack between the boards and into the pit, like the broad, sharp blade of a guillotine gliding through a mass of gelatin. It swept down through the darkness to land on my ankle. I dropped the bell and covered my face to protect my eyes. Next, one of the boards was moved to the side, and even more sunlight flooded in. Though my eyes were closed and my palms were pressed against them, I could feel the darkness turn to light. Then new air flowed in from above. It was fresh and cold and filled with the fragrance of early winter. I loved that smell. I remembered how I had felt as a child wrapping a scarf around my neck on the first cold morning of the year, the softness of the wool against my skin. Someone was calling my name from the top of the pit. At least it seemed to be my name. I had forgotten I had one. Names possessed no meaning in the world where I had been for so long. It took me a while to connect the someone calling my name with Wataru Menshiki. I shouted back, but no words emerged. All I could produce was a sort of growl, a signal that I was still alive. I wasn't sure my voice was strong enough to reach him, but at least I could hear it. The strange, harsh call of some imaginary beast.
"Are you all right?" Menshiki called down.
"Menshiki?"
"Yes, it's me," Menshiki said. "Are you hurt?"
"No, I'm all right," I said. My voice had returned. "I think," I added.
"How long have you been down there?"
"I don't know. It just happened."
"Can you climb the ladder if I lower it to you?"
"I think so," I said. "Probably."
"Wait just a minute. I'll go get it."
My eyes began to adjust to the sunlight as I waited. I still couldn't open them all the way, but at least I didn't have to cover them with my hands. As luck would have it, it wasn't that bright. I could tell it was daytime, but the sky was probably blanketed with clouds, or else dusk was approaching. At last, I heard the metal ladder being lowered.
"Please give me a little more time," I said. "My eyes aren't used to the light, so I have to be careful."
"Of course. Take all the time you want," said Menshiki.
Why was the pit so dark? There was no light at all.
I covered it 2 days ago. It looked like someone had been monkeying with the lid, so I brought a heavy top from my house and tied it down with metal pegs and twine so it wouldn't budge. I didn't want a child to slip and fall in. I checked first to be sure no one was inside. It was empty then, I'm sure of it.
It made perfect sense. Menshiki had covered the lid. That's why it had been so dark.
There were no signs that anyone had tampered with the tarp. It was just as I left it. So how did you get in? I don't understand, Menshiki said.
I don't understand either, I said. It just happened. There was nothing more I could tell him, and I had no intention of trying to explain either.
Shall I come down? Menshiki asked.
No, please stay where you are. I'll come up.
I could keep my eyes half open now. Mysterious images were churning behind them, but at least my mind was functioning. I lined up the ladder against the wall, put my foot on the lowest rung, and tried to push myself up. But my legs were weak. They didn't feel like my legs at all. Still, I was able to gingerly climb up the ladder, one rung at a time. The air grew fresher the closer I got to the surface. I could hear birds chirping. When I reached the top, Menshiki took my wrist in an iron grip and pulled me out. He was much stronger than I expected. Strong enough that I gave myself over to his hands without a second thought. Gratitude was all I felt. Out of the hole, I flopped onto my back and looked up at the dim sky. Sure enough, it was covered by gray clouds. I couldn't tell the time of day. Tiny pellets of rain struck my cheeks and forehead. I found the irregular way they landed on my face exhilarating. I had never realized what a blessing rain could be. It was so full of life. Even the first cold rain of winter. I'm starving, and thirsty, and cold. I'm freezing, I said. That's all I could get out. My teeth were chattering. Menshiki guided me through the woods, his arm wrapped around my shoulder. I was having a hard time putting one foot in front of the other. By the end, he was pulling me along. He was a lot more powerful than he looked. Those daily workouts of his were paying off.
Do you have the key? Menshiki asked.
It's under the potted plant to the right of the front door. Probably.
The probably was necessary. Nothing in this world could be stated with absolute certainty. I was still shaking with cold. The chattering of my teeth was so loud I could barely hear myself talk.
You'll be happy to hear Maria returned home safe and sound early this afternoon, Menshiki said. What a relief. I got a call from Shoko about an hour ago. I'd been calling you, but no one ever picked up. That worried me, so I came over. I could hear the faint ring of a bell coming from the woods. So, on a hunch, I came out and removed the tarp. The view opened up as we emerged from the trees. I could see Menshiki's silver jaguar parked demurely in front of my house. It was as spotless as ever.
Why is your car always so beautiful? I asked Menshiki. Not a fitting question under the circumstances, perhaps, but something I had long wanted to ask.
I don't know, he said in a disinterested tone. Maybe it's because I wash it when I have nothing else to do, from front to back. Then once a month a pro comes and waxes it, and my garage protects it from the elements. That's all.
That's all? If my poor Toyota Corolla wagon heard that, after 6 months spent languishing in wind and rain, its shoulders would sag in dismay. It might even pass out.
Menshiki took the key from under the flower pot and opened the door.
By the way, what day of the week is it? I asked him.
Today? Today is Tuesday.
Tuesday? Are you sure?
Menshiki double-checked his memory. I put out the empty bottles and cans yesterday, so it must have been Monday. Therefore, today is Tuesday, without a doubt.
It had been Saturday when I had visited Tomohiko Amada's room. So 3 days had passed. It wouldn't have surprised me had it been 3 weeks, or 3 months, or even 3 years. I made a mental note. I rubbed my jaw with my palm, but there was no 3-day stubble. Instead, my chin was smooth. What explained that?
Menshiki took me to the bath straight away. He put me in a hot shower and brought me a fresh change of clothes. The clothes I had been wearing were tattered and filthy. I rolled them up in a ball and threw them in the garbage. There were red contusions all over my body, but no visible injuries. I wasn't bleeding. Then he led me to the kitchen, sat me down, and slowly fed me water. By the end, I had drained a big bottle of mineral water. While I was drinking, he found several apples in the fridge and peeled them. I just sat there, admiring his skill with a knife. The plate of peeled apples looked beautiful, elegant even. I ate 3 or 4 apples in all. It was a moving experience. I had never realized how delicious apples were. I wanted to thank their creator for inventing such a marvelous fruit. When I finished the apples, Menshiki dug up a carton of crackers and gave it to me. I emptied the box. The crackers were a bit soggy, but they still tasted like the best in the world. In the meantime, he boiled water, made tea, and mixed it with honey. I drank a number of cups. The tea and honey warmed me from the inside. There wasn't much in my fridge. It was, however, well stocked with eggs.
How about an omelet? Menshiki asked.
I'd love one, I said. I needed to fill my stomach. Anything would do.
Menshiki took 4 eggs from the fridge, broke them in a bowl, whipped them with chopsticks, and added milk, salt, and pepper. Then he whipped them again. It was clear he knew what he was doing. Then he turned on the gas, chose a small frying pan, and melted some butter in it. He located a spatula in one of my drawers and deftly cooked the omelet. His technique was remarkable, as I would have expected. He could have been featured on a TV cooking show. Housewives across the nation would have sighed with envy. When it came to omelets, when it came to anything, I should say, Menshiki was precise, efficient, and incredibly stylish. I could only look on in admiration. He slid the finished omelet onto a plate and gave it to me with a dollop of ketchup. The finished omelet was so beautiful, I wanted to sketch it. But instead, I grabbed my knife and started eating. The omelet wasn't just pretty to look at. It was delicious. This omelet is perfection, I said.
Menshiki laughed. Not really. I've made better.
What sort of omelet could that have been? One that sprouted wings and flew from Tokyo to Osaka in under 2 hours? When I had polished off the omelet, he took my plate to the sink. At last, my stomach felt comfortable. Menshiki sat down across the table from me.
Can we talk a little? He asked me.
Certainly, I said.
Aren't you tired?
Maybe so, but we have lots to talk about.
Menshiki nodded. It appears that several blanks need filling in.
If they can be filled in, I thought.
Actually, I stopped by Sunday afternoon, Menshiki said. I'd called many times, but you never picked up, so I was a little worried. I got here around 1.
I nodded. I had been somewhere else around then.
I rang the bell, and Tomohiko Amada's son came to the door. Masahiko, is that right?
Yes, Masahiko Amada, an old friend. He owns this house, and he's got a key so he can get in when I'm not here.
He was, how should I put this, very worried about you. He said the two of you were visiting his father's room in the nursing home last Saturday. when all of a sudden you disappeared. I nodded, but didn't say anything. He said you vanished into thin air while he was out of the room making a phone call. The nursing home is in Izukogen, so the nearest station is too far to reach on foot. But there were no signs that anyone had called a taxi, and the receptionist and the security guard hadn't seen you leave either. Masahiko called your home later, but no one answered. He was so alarmed that he drove all the way here to check. He was concerned about your safety, worried something bad had happened to you. I sighed. I'll try to explain things to Masahiko. His father's in bad shape, and I only added to his worries. How is his father, by the way? Did he say anything?
It seems he's been in a coma. Hasn't regained consciousness at all. His son has taken a room near the home. He was on his way back to Tokyo when he stopped by here.
I should call him right away, I said, shaking my head.
That's true, Menshiki said, placing his hands on the table. But first, I think you need to come up with a coherent story about where you've been and what you've been doing the past few days, including an explanation of how you disappeared from the nursing home. No one's going to buy it if you tell them you just woke up and found yourself back here.
You're right, I said. But how about you? Can you buy my story?
Menshiki thought for a moment. His brow was puckered, as if he was having trouble deciding what to say.
I've always been a man who thought along rational lines, he said at last. That's how I was trained. To be honest, though, I can't be logical where the pit behind the shrine is concerned. Anything could happen there, and it wouldn't feel strange in the least. Spending an hour inside the pit brought that home all the more. That place is more than just a hole in the ground, but I doubt anyone who hasn't experienced it could understand.
I couldn't find the right words to respond, so I stayed silent.
I think you should take the position, I don't remember anything, and then stick with it, Menshiki said. I don't know how many people will believe you, but from what I can see, that's your only option.
I nodded. Yes, that could well be my only option.
There are some things that can't be explained in this life, Menshiki went on, and some others that probably shouldn't be explained, especially when putting them into words ignores what is most crucial.
You've experienced that, correct?
Of course, Menshiki said with a small smile. More than once.
I drained what was left in my teacup. So Maria wasn't hurt at all? I asked.
She was muddy and scratched up, but had no serious injuries. Not much more than a skinned knee. Just like you.
Just like me? Where was she these past few days? Menshiki looked perplexed.
I'm pretty much in the dark about that, too. What I do know is that she returned home a short while ago, dirty and banged up. That's all I was told. Shoko was in such a state she couldn't explain much over the phone. You should probably ask her yourself when things have settled down. Or, if possible, ask Maria directly.
I nodded. You're right. I'll do that.
Don't you think you should get some sleep? Menshiki asked.
No sooner had these words left his mouth than sleepiness hit me. I had slept deeply while I was in the pit, at least I think I had, but now I could barely keep my eyes open.
Yes, you're right. I think I'll go lie down, I said, looking at the backs of his clasped hands, perfectly aligned on the table.
Have a good sleep. That's what you need right now. Is there anything else I can do for you?
I shook my head. No, I can't think of anything. But thanks.
Then I'll take off. Please don't hesitate to call me for whatever reason. I should be at home for the next little while.
He slowly rose to his feet. Thank goodness Maria got home safely, and that I was able to help you out of a tough spot. To tell the truth, I haven't had much sleep these days either, so I think I'll go home and rest. With that, he left. As always, I heard the solid thunk of his car door slamming shut and the engine starting up. I waited until the car was out of earshot before heading for bed. When my head hit the pillow, I remembered the old bell. I had left it and the flashlight in the pit for a split second. Then I descended into a deep sleep. Chapter 57. Something I Have to Do Eventually. I awoke at 2:15, again surrounded by total darkness. For a split second, I was under the illusion that I was still in the pit, but I realized my mistake right away. There was a clear difference between the darkness here and there. Above ground, there was always a vestige of light, even on the blackest night. Not like underground, where no light could enter. It may have been 2:15, but the sun was still in the sky, albeit on the other side of the planet. That was the size of it. I turned on the light, went to the bathroom, and drank glass after glass of cold water. The house was hushed. Too hushed, in fact. I listened carefully, but could hear nothing. No breeze. No insect voices since it was winter, no night birds, no bell. Come to think of it, I had first heard the bell ringing at precisely this time of night, the time when events outside the normal are most likely to occur. I was no longer sleepy, I was wide awake. Draping a sweater over my pajamas, I headed for the studio. I hadn't set foot in there since returning home, and I was concerned about the paintings I had left, especially Killing Commendatore. Menshiki had said that Masahiko had visited the house in my absence. If he had gone into the studio, he might have stumbled upon it. He would have known right away that it was his father's work. Fortunately, however, I had covered it. I'd worried about leaving it exposed, so I had taken it down from the wall and wrapped a sheet around it to hide it from inquisitive eyes. If the sheet hadn't been removed, Masahiko ought not to have seen it. I walked in and flipped on the wall switch. The studio was dead quiet as well. Needless to say, no one was there. Not the Commendatore, not Tomohiko Amada. I was all alone. Killing Commendatore was where I had left it on the floor, the sheet still in place. It didn't seem that anyone had touched it. I couldn't be sure, of course, but nothing suggested otherwise. I unwrapped the painting. It looked the same as always. There was the Commendatore, and Don Giovanni, who had run him through with his sword, and the shocked servant Leporello, and the beautiful Donna Anna, covering her mouth in astonishment. And in the lower left-hand corner of the painting, poking his head through the square opening, the creepy-looking long face. In truth, I had been harboring some misgivings. Might the painting have been altered by the series of events in which I had played a part? Long face deleted from the scene, for example, because I had shut the lid? Or the Commendatore killed, not with a sword, but with a carving knife? Yet, search as I might, I could find nothing changed. Long Face still poked his grotesque face out of his hole, the raised lid in one hand. His saucer eyes still surveyed the scene. The Commendatore was still impaled on a long sword, blood spewing from his heart. The painting remained a perfectly composed work of art. I admired it for a while, then put the sheet back over it. I turned to look at the two paintings I was working on. They sat side by side on two easels. One, the pit in the woods, was wider than it was tall. The other, a portrait of Maria Akikawa, was taller than it was wide. I looked at them carefully. Both were exactly as I had left them. Nothing had been changed. One was finished, while the other awaited a final go-around. Then I turned the man with the white Subaru Forester, which had been facing the wall, sat on the floor, and took another good look at it. The man with the white Subaru Forester stared back at me from behind the thick layers of paint, which I had applied with my palette knife in several colors. He had no concrete shape, but I could see him there nonetheless. He was looking straight at me with the piercing eyes of a nocturnal bird of prey, his face empty of expression. He was dead set against the completion of his portrait, the exposure of his true form to the world, against being hauled from the dark into the light. But I was determined to reveal who he was. I had to drag him out into full view, however much he might resist. The time might not yet have come, but when it did, I had to be ready to follow through. I returned to a portrait of Maria Akikawa. It was far enough along that I didn't need Maria to model for me anymore. Only a series of final technical operations remained. Then the portrait would be basically done. I thought it might turn out to be my most accomplished work to date. At the very least, it would capture the freshness of that beautiful 13-year-old girl. I was confident of that, but I knew I would never take those last steps. By leaving it unfinished, I was shielding something within her, even though I didn't know what that something was. That much was clear. I needed to look after a few things right away. I had to call Shoko and hear the full story of Maria's return. I had to call Yuzu and tell her I wanted to see her to talk things out, as I had resolved at the bottom of the pit, that it was time for us to meet. Then, of course, I had to talk to Masahiko, to explain how it was that I had vanished suddenly from his father's room at the nursing home, and tell him where I had been for the 3 days I was missing and unaccounted for, though what I would say, what was possible to say, escaped me. Clearly, I couldn't call any of them now. I had to wait for a more appropriate time. That would come in due course, assuming, that is, the time was behaving normally. I drank a glass of warm milk that I heated on the stove and nibbled some biscuits as I sat and looked out the window. It was pitch black outside. No stars were out. Daybreak was still a while off. It was the time of year when nights were the longest. How should I pass the time? The proper thing would be to climb back into bed, but I wasn't at all sleepy. I didn't feel like reading or working. With nothing better to do, I decided to run a bath. While the bathtub was filling, I lay on my back and stared at the ceiling. Why had it been necessary to pass through that underground world? To make that trip, I had been forced to kill the Commendatore with my own hands. He had sacrificed his life, and I had been compelled to endure one ordeal after another in a world of darkness. There had to have been a reason. The underground realm was full of unmistakable danger and real fear. Down there, the most outlandish occurrences weren't strange at all. By successfully navigating that realm, I seemed to have freed Maria from somewhere. At least she had returned home safely, as the Commendatore had foretold. But what connected my experiences underground and her safe return? Were they somehow parallel? Perhaps the river water I had ingested was an important piece of the puzzle. It could have altered something in me. I felt that at an intuitive and physical level, though it made no rational sense. Thanks to that change, I had passed through a tunnel clearly too small for my body. Cheered on by Donna Anna and Komi, I had managed to overcome my deep-rooted claustrophobia. No, Donna Anna and Komi could have been a single entity. Donna Anna at one moment, Komi at the next. Together, perhaps, they had shielded me from the dark powers
and protected Maria Akikawa at the same time. But where had Maria been confined? Had she been confined in the first place? When I had given her penguin charm, though given didn't really cover it, to the faceless man, had I harmed her? Or, conversely, had the charm in some shape or form protected her in the end? The questions only mounted. Perhaps I would understand the events of the past few days better once I met Maria in person. I would have to wait. True, things might be no clearer even after we talked. Maria might recall nothing, or she might remember but, like me, be unwilling to share her story. At any rate, I had to see her once more in this real world and have a good long talk. We needed to share our stories about what had happened to us, if at all possible. But was this the real world? I looked around. So much was familiar. The breeze through the window carried a familiar smell. The sounds outside were familiar sounds. Just because it looked like the real world at first glance, however, didn't mean that was necessarily the case. It might be no more than my assumption. I might well have descended through one hole in Izu and traveled the underworld, only to be spit out 3 days later through the wrong hole in the mountains of Odawara. There was no guarantee that the world I had left and the world I had returned to were one and the same. I rose from the sofa, stripped off my clothes, and stepped into the bathroom. Once again, I soaped and scrubbed every inch of my body. I thoroughly washed my hair. I brushed my teeth, swabbed my ears with cotton, trimmed my nails. I shaved, though there wasn't much beard to shave. I put on another set of clean underwear, a freshly ironed white cotton shirt and a pair of khaki pants with a sharp crease. I strove to make myself look as acceptable as I could to the real world, but the night still hadn't ended. Outside was pitch black, so black I felt morning might never arrive, not for all eternity. But morning did come. I brewed some fresh coffee and made some buttered toast. The fridge was almost bare. 2 eggs, some sour milk, and a few limp vegetables. I made a mental note to go shopping later. I was washing the coffee cup when it struck me that I hadn't seen my girlfriend in some time. How long had it been? I couldn't count the exact number of days without checking my calendar, but I knew quite a while had passed. So many things had been going on, a number of them literally not in this world, that I hadn't noticed her failure to contact me. Why was that? She called me at least twice every week. How's it going? She would say. I couldn't call her, though. She couldn't give me her cell phone number, and I didn't use email. When I wanted to see her, I had to wait for her call. Sure enough, my girlfriend did call around 9 that morning, when she was still in the back of my mind. I've got to talk to you about something, she said, skipping the pleasantries. Fine, let's talk, I said. I leaned against the kitchen counter, phone to my ear. The clouds outside were starting to break up, and the early winter sun was peeking through the gaps. The weather, at least, was improving. From the sound of it, though, what she had to say wasn't going to be all that pleasant. I think it's best if we don't see each other again, she said. It's too bad, but... Her tone was flat and dispassionate. I couldn't tell if she really felt it was too bad or not. There are a number of reasons, she said. A number of reasons, I echoed. To begin with, I think my husband is catching on. He's noticed some signs. Signs, I repeated. Women leave certain signs in situations like this, like they start paying more attention to their makeup and their clothes, or change their perfume, or start a serious diet. I've tried to be careful, but even so... I see. The main thing is we can't go on like this,
like this, I repeated. With no future, no hope of resolution. She had it there. Our relationship had no future,